David Frick, everybody, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm very impressed that anybody is here at this hour. So, congratulations.
Yeah, I'm perfect. I also should say that we've been trying to get some people like you over here and getting almost scandalous offers for them to come, but you've been nothing but cool with us.
Well, this is a cool event, and I always feel very lucky and grateful when I get invited to go to other cities to immerse myself in the culture and the history and just the architecture, just walking around, you know, Christmas lights and snow, record stores, what's not to love? You know, this is my idea of a good time, and it's good work because hopefully I'm experiencing something I can then bring back to whatever I do, whether it's writing or radio or even just talking to people, you know, friends or colleagues or just, you know, strangers at gigs on the subway and saying, hey, you know, I saw this band, you should check it out. And as much as I'm suspicious of the internet, it means that people can check them out. And, you know, hopefully then put some good hard money down and buy the record and support the band and the artist.
Perfect. So since we should be talking a little bit about festivals and getting ready for a festival, and you've obviously experienced quite a few, when doing some research on you, I found out that you went to the original 69 Woodstock Festival.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
There was a lot of mud. It rained. More people showed up than they expected. I was one of the few who actually bought a ticket for all 3 days. And it's the one ticket stub I lost. I have every other ticket stub from every other show that I've been to where there was a ticket. That one is in the mud somewhere up in upstate New York. But the one thing that I got to say about that event, and people ask me about it all the time, it's not like I was the only guy there. There were like another 500,000 people.
Yep.
But even if the music had sucked, which it didn't, one of the things that was, the reason we remember that festival probably in nostalgic terms and why people have tried to recreate it over and over again is that brought together by the music and this promise of a great weekend, what happened was essentially a disaster. It was declared a disaster area by the state of New York because there were too many people, there were no services, there was not enough medical attention, there was very little food. And as John Fogerty pointed out when I interviewed him about Woodstock just a couple of years ago, he said, you know, 500,000 people showed up and nobody thought to bring an umbrella. You know, not the brightest minds of our generation. But we all banded together and took care of each other. It was essentially a refugee camp. You know, not the kind that you see in Syria or Darfur. But the fact was, you know, a lot more people could have died and been hurt than there were because we all decided that, you know, if we're in this mess, let's just look after each other. And my friends and I, we actually brought food in our camper van, and we ended up cooking food for people and giving it away because people didn't have anything. And as much as I do treasure the music I did get to see, I wasn't there the whole weekend because I had a job. I was trying to make money for college, so I had to get back on the Sunday. But that Saturday, the music was incredible, but the thing I remember most is just people banding together and making the most of a pretty almost dangerous situation because there was no way you could organize that crowd, and yet everyone organized themselves.
How did it even work getting out of Woodstock and going back to where you lived at the time?
Well, the traffic going back wasn't as bad as it was getting in.
Okay.
We parked by the side of the road and used that van basically as our tent. We slept in the van. I was doing it before Henry Rollins. But we, you know, then you walk to the site, you saw the music, you walk back, you chilled out. We actually built a fire. I was a Boy Scout. I knew how to build a fire. And we cooked spaghetti and hot dogs. And there was a guy who came up who didn't have anything to eat. And he said, man, can you give us some? I said, sure. You know, we just, you know, gave him some of our food. And he said, well, look, I don't have anything to pay. And I said, we don't need money. This is not a money scenario. And he said, well, would you take some acid? I said, dude, why don't you just hold on to that? I think you need it more than I do. But yeah, that's actually one of the primary memories that I bring back is that encounter with that guy. And, you know, it's a reminder when you're 16, 17 years old that, you know, you have a responsibility in the world to take care of those next to you, even if you don't know who they are. And, you know, we talk about festivals now and how organized they are and, you know, the ticketing, security, you know, show times, food booths, you know, are they cashless? None of that applied because none of that existed. And yet everyone wants to know about that first Woodstock. You know, you can talk about all of the Roskildes and the Coachellas, and those are all fantastic events, but do they make history? And I'm not sure they made history in the same way, because Woodstock was a success in humanity, and most festivals now are successes in terms of the music and the commerce.
Yeah, and festivals these days are way more branded, I guess, and it feels like being in the mall at some festivals.
And that's all right, you know. Things change, and I don't think I'd want to experience that again. One of the reasons I've never been to, say, Bonnaroo is because I am not camping again, ever. No fucking way. You know, either give me a hotel room or I'm staying home. But having done it, I know what's possible in people. And I think that was, to me, that's the great lesson of that event. You know, the fact that the music was pretty amazing, too, that was a big plus.
Yeah, of course. So if we move forward out of the Woodstock area, and
I've been trying to do that for a very long time. So.
All right, but with the traveling circus festivals types of Lollapalooza when they started coming in the 90s, were you covering them or were you just attending them?
I covered the first Lollapalooza. I went out on the road for about 3-4 shows maybe, and since it was the first one, it was kind of interesting because it was, I think, actually the most successful of them because it hadn't been done before, whereas everything that came after was about, you know, who's on the bill as opposed to what's the quality of the event. And Perry Farrell, who was really the creative drive in putting Lollapalooza together, it was basically what he was trying to do was create a movable Glastonbury or a movable Reading Festival. That vibe that you get from these English and European events that Jane's had played, Jane's Addiction, and make that something you could do in the U.S. But in the U.S., it's got to be a traveling thing, because you wouldn't be able to just put it in one place and then have everyone come there. Bonnaroo and Coachella are exceptions to that rule, but certainly in the 90s, the early 90s, you had to, you know, take it around the country. And what they did was put together a great bill that you look at it now and you think, how is it possible that Nine Inch Nails was opening at like 3 p.m. in the afternoon? You know, Trent Reznor had never even seen daylight before. So he really complained about that when I interviewed him. I said, God, it's too fucking early, man. You know, he's got, you know, his skin is white and he's never been out in the sun before. But then, you know, Rollins actually opened the day at like 2 p.m., and, you know, there weren't that many people there. He played like the place was full. And his commitment to just delivering what he had to those who were there was pretty inspiring, even if he was a kind of a slightly scary guy. But when you sat down and talked with him, he was like straight to the point. And, you know, it's all that coffee and carbo that he eats, you know. It's like... Yeah. Totally straight edge, but man, he was great. Butthole Surfers were great. Jane's Addiction with, you know, Ice-T coming out and doing, you know, the Sly Stone song, Don't Call Me Nigger Whitey, Don't Call Me Whitey Nigger. You know, talk about dealing with those kind of issues in 1991. It was a pretty amazing day. And I think it set a great standard for Lollapalooza as an event. And of course, they've got Lollapaloozas now in Chicago, and Pitchfork has their thing. So in a sense, you know, Perry Farrell created a template that I think still exists today. You know, it's bigger in the sense of, say, maybe a Coachella or a Bonnaroo, but what he did was take that English festival, European festival, like Roskilde and, you know, things you do here in Sweden and in Germany, but and put it in the States and really create a model that could be built on and that has evolved today.
Cool. And from that, and since we didn't really schedule this talk, otherwise we should have done a bigger time frame for this, but since we only have a little limited amount, if you take it the next festival level, like our festival is a small type festival, and I know you've been to Romania, was it pretty recently?
Well, I was just in Bulgaria. For a thing called So Alive, which was actually on the same scale. It was the first time they'd ever done it. It was in Sofia. And it was a really good vibe. It was very much like this. It was almost like you were doing something in the neighborhood, except the building that they had the shows in was the National Palace of Culture, which had been built by the Communist Party back in, like, 1981. It's not the prettiest building in the world. But then you could say that a lot about Soviet architecture. But it was a great event because it actually brought together artists from the region so that there were people from Bosnia and Macedonia performing, you know, using their traditional ethnic styles and cultures in ways that related to contemporary music as well. So I heard a lot of really fantastic music, and you know there were three venues, I don't know, maybe 40 acts across the two main days, mm-hmm. but it was very much like this, which was, you know, you can move from venue to venue, there are people to talk to, the music's good, I'm learning something, I take some records home, I play some things on the radio, which is what I did from here last year.
Yeah.
You know, it's. I actually like the scale of things like this because it's really quite humane. You know, there's a lot of time to talk to people. People want to ask me questions. I'm curious what they're listening to. You know, I like South by Southwest in Texas. It's a bigger scale, but actually, it started out the same way. It's just that it got very, very successful. But it was exactly the same thing in Texas. The first South By I went to, the entire thing took place in one hotel, and that included the shows.
All right.
So you all got to start somewhere.
Yeah, and final question and rounding up. I mean, you told me that you had a pretty basic rule with your wife in order to travel like this. Could you share that rule?
Don't get sick.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
You know, try to sleep, try to eat. Don't come home sick, and otherwise just, you know, experience as much as you can, because otherwise I'd be at home riding the subway, going to the places that I know, which is great. I have a great life in New York, but to be able to come here, go to Reykjavik, go to Sofia, spot in Denmark, which is one of my favorite events, you know, places, you know, events that I've done in South America and you know, just all over. I like the idea that I can travel the world and experience all of the music in the world. And I'm not going to waste time not doing it. You know, if I'm here, I'm going to make the most of what I do. This thing up there says getting ready. I had my coffee. I had some sleep. I'm ready.